Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Wednesday, June 5th meeting of the Senate Committee on Rules, and we have a lot to get through, and we're going to have to skip around due to people's busy schedules. So we will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 789. And Lori, could you briefly tell us what this is?
Senate Bill 789 limits the total period of time a school district or educational service district is subject to actuarial analysis to 6 years when district provides health benefit plans other than those provided by Oregon Educators Benefit Board. Clarifies requirement for actuarial analysis does not apply to certain self-insured districts, districts with independent health insurance trusts, or community college districts. There's a dash two. That eliminates the current requirement actuarial analysis be performed at least once every 2 years. There's no revenue impact on the dash two. However, we do not have a fiscal statement on the amendment.
Okay, thank you, Lori. And I see Senator Haas is here to talk about this. If you'd like to come forward and if you have a friend, I know you have lots of friends, but one in particular you'd like to come forward. Good morning. Welcome to Senate Rules.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Committee. In 12 years, I've never before come before the Senate Rules Committee, so please.
You're in for a treat.
Yes. Thank you, Mark Haas, Senate District 14, Beaverton and Aloha. Last fall, the Beaverton School District asked me to help them with a bill that would relieve them of the administrative and financial burden of running an actuarial comparison between their private health insurance and OEBB. They and 10 other Oregon school districts are saving millions of dollars every year by opting out of that plan and using their own insurance. And when I look at that calculus, it translates into hundreds of teachers. So I was convinced, and since these school districts have consistently shown for at least 6 years that opting out of OEBB saves so much money, I think it's reasonable and efficient governing to relieve them of this reporting requirement. Beaverton, as an aside, has saved $28 million in 6 years by opting out of OEBB. I'm here today to support the Dash 2 amendments. These amendments are the result of a work group between the OEA and the 11 school districts that SB 789 will impact. Essentially, these amendments make it so school districts do not have to run these comparability analyses every 2 years. However, they still would be required to run one if it's requested by an employee bargaining group or a school district. It isn't often that we have a work group that quickly comes to an agreement like this to find a compromise that fulfills the intent of the original bill, but I think this was one of those times. This bill supports our school districts, and it will help them save time, money, and an unnecessary burden. So I hope you'll support the Dash 2 amendments and move this bill to the floor. We have some people here from Beaverton and Portland behind us who can fill you in on any technical details you need, and Justin is here to join the party.
Great. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Justin Black from the Oregon Education Association. Let me first thank Debbie Johnson from Beaverton School District and Senator Haas here for having some really good conversations about the cost drivers in healthcare and what's raising costs for our members and giving us a chance to step back, analyze the problem, and come back with a dash two that is really helpful. I think our members, it still keeps the ability for our members to ask for the actuarial analysis to make sure they're getting the best benefit possible. We're in full support of it. We hope that there can be some other looks at what are driving costs in OEB right now so that we can rein in costs for everybody. I think at the end of the day, we're all after the same thing, which is great care for our school employees at the best possible cost. And I will leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you for bringing this to us. And looks like Senator Starr has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So 10 or 11 districts are out of OEBB?
That's right.
And those districts are saving millions of dollars by being able to go into the private market? Is that correct?
These are, yeah. These 11 have.
Is there a reason why we wouldn't want to provide other school districts the opportunity to save millions of dollars and turn those dollars into more teachers and lower class sizes and more school days and a broader education opportunity for Oregon school kids?
Senator Starr, Chair Rosenbaum, OEB's done a couple actuarial studies on it. They had, I believe it was Towers Watson, And I'm forgetting the other actuary that did it. OEB is saving districts. They averaged about $50 million a year. Also, every district gets the chance coming into OEB to do a comparability study of whether they would save money staying out. And that's what's happened in the case of Beaverton and Portland and the districts that are out. They've been able to prove that they can save money staying outside of OEB. Other districts were given that chance and either unable to prove they were saving money or just decided not to do it and went into OEB.
So, just to follow up, I've had conversations with the districts and the school districts in my legislative district, and for whatever reason, they believe they'd be able to save significant money if they were out of OEBB. And I just believe we ought to provide that opportunity for school districts across the board. And, Madam Chair, to that end, I asked Legislative Council to draft an amendment to the bill. I just got it this morning, so I'd like to distribute that to the committee. It's a -3 amendment. So,
has the committee administrator received it? Or?
No, we just got it this morning, so
okay.
it's an hard copy here. We can make it available via OLIS, but I would like to have it considered by the committee.
So we'll give it to the committee assistant. Obviously, nobody's seen it
right.
Since you didn't have it. So,
thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or comments for these folks? Okay. Thank you very much, and we'll let you go about your duties. So, members, we have another legislator in the room on another bill. So we will recess the hearing on Senate Bill 789. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 300 for the purposes of taking Senator Johnson's testimony so that she can get about her other duties. And Lori, could you briefly tell us about Senate Bill 300?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 300 provides that certain persons appointed by the governor and certain persons appointed to positions in executive departments serve at pleasure of governor. Remove statutory language that may be in conflict with measure provisions that persons serving in those positions do so at the pleasure of the governor. It declares an emergency. It's effective on passage. You have hard copy of two different sets of amendments. The -3s, I do not believe, are amendments the proponents want to move forward. You now have the -5s, which we just received, so I apologize, but I cannot speak to those, but I think there are people here who will be able to.
And Senator Johnson, if you'd like to come forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You extended the courtesy to Senator Hass to have a lifeline. May I have a lifeline, too?
Absolutely.
Ms. Clausen, Kendall Clausen from the Governor's Office. Excuse me while I go through the docking procedure here. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I represent Senate District 16. And despite my unalloyed support for Senate Bill 300, let me start by saying this isn't a perfect bill. But it begins, I think, a long overdue conversation. And I know that it has generated a lot of discussion since it was scheduled. There are a flurry of amendments saying, take us out, or you couldn't have possibly meant to include, fill in the blank. But as today's hearing unfolds, I think you'll hear more about the problem statement. What's the underlying issue that would give rise to a bill like this? You'll hear about the technical aspects of the bill. And while the piece of legislation remains a work in progress and very fluid at this point, I think it's a good starting place to begin the discussion. I hope that members of the committee will view this bill as a best practices piece of legislation designed to provide accountability and transparency to a valued process in Oregon. And that process invites citizen participation on a plethora of boards and commissions. I think you'll hear from Ms. Clausen exactly how many Oregonians are touched by our citizen service in advising boards and commissions. But it also is a process that provides flexibility to the executive branch to assemble an executive branch team of state agency heads that are responsive to both the legislature and the chief executive officer of the state, regardless of who that person is or what party they belong to. And with that, I'm pleased to introduce Kendall Clausen, who is the governor's director of executive appointments, who first enlightened me as to some of the emerging issues with respect to executive appointments that I don't frankly think have come to the attention of the body previously. And I thank Ms. Clausen's leadership for helping educate me about the work that she does.
Great. Good morning.
Good morning. Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kendall Claussen. I'm Director of Executive Appointments for Governor Kitzhaber. And I'd like to thank Senator Johnson for inviting me to speak with you today, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Dash 5 amendment. Over the course of the last year, about 2.5 years that I've been in this position, I've worked extensively with this committee and other members of the Senate in order to place hundreds of Oregonians into volunteer opportunities to serve the state and the public. Right now, we guesstimate that we're at about 2,600 to 2,700 members of our team are serving as volunteers. Though infrequently, I have worked with each of you when we discover that there might be a challenge with a commission or an agency, and I'm often the first person that you call when we need to raise a concern about the performance of someone in one of these positions. From the governor's office perspective, the Dash 5 amendment raises the question of transparency and accountability. State government, the executive and legislative branches are held accountable for the actions of our boards and commissions and our agency directors, but we don't often, in many cases, have the authority to address those concerns. We're also very interested in doing the best that we can to reduce risk when it comes to the participants on these boards and commissions and overall for the state and for the general public to whom we're all held accountable. The Dash 5 amendment offers the governor tools that most executives in similar situations would inherently have to either adjust their course or to make shifts in personnel as needed. So from a transparency perspective, we're just very interested in being able to do whatever possible to have a conversation about creating clear lines of authority and responsibility and make sure that we're able to demonstrate the appropriate actions. So once again, thank you for the opportunity to meet with you today.
Great. Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kendall, that was about as much in code as I've ever heard. What are you talking about?
Well, I think what we face, Chair Rosenbaum and Senator Beyer, we face ongoing challenges when we don't have the authority to make decisions when challenges arise. So it's very clear in most board statutes that the governor or other appointing bodies have the authority to decide who gets onto a board or commission. It's not a common occurrence, but on those occasions when challenges arise, we spend more time determining who has accountability and responsibility for answering challenges than we do addressing them.
So you're really talking about the right to, for all boards and commissions to serve at the will of the governor.
Yes.
Pleasure of the governor.
Or the appointing body. Right. The governor has some responsibility for appointing and other members.
So there are two issues here. The appointment of members of boards and commissions, which rest with the governor now, subject to Senate confirmation.
Yes, sir.
And the second level, then, is the appointment, in many cases, of the chief executive of the agency, which currently is conveyed on the boards and commissions to choose their person.
Correct. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Byers, the governor has responsibility for appointing both agency directors and members of boards and commissions. So at issue are both categories. Particularly around agency directors, it's especially necessary to have an understanding of who has responsibility and accountability for oversight or decision making when challenges occur. So this amendment allows us the opportunity to have conversations and to make decisions when changes are necessary.
As a former small agency administrator and having talked with many others, it has always been the understanding that agency administrators serve at the will of the governor. Although the language is different on different ones, it was always understood that if the governor called you and said, I would like your resignation, that you tendered it. There have been a couple of recent exceptions to that. But that's always been there. In fact, I think Governor Kitzhaber, when he started informally, perhaps, and I know a couple other governors have done when they start offices, they ask for the blanket offer of resignation from all executives. Now, that's not true of the commissioners, but it is true of all state positions, and fortunately, most of the time, those are turned down. But I think that is a standard. So I think we're talking about a difference of theory versus actual practice.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, indeed. It's amazing what clear knowledge does in these circumstances. And it certainly would keep the conversation from dragging on for months on end in a back and forth dialogue about this when we could assume what you just described, or we could have actual rules that show this is how this works. We want to operate from a place of knowledge, not assumption.
But you just set up another conflict by making them all. I mean, the assumption for boards and commissions in Oregon has been historically a system of strong boards and commissions. I mean, it's a historic practice. It's true in a number of other states. But the question then, if you have a board that's conveyed by legislation the power to control, if they don't have, if there's a separative direction between the commissioner board and the governor's office, you have a bit of a problem there in terms of for the administrator saying, okay, who do I work for? Do I really care what this board thinks, or do I only care what the governor thinks? So I mean, there's a dynamic. I'm not sure if one's right or wrong, but there's a dynamic that's there.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, I think the most important thing is that we open a conversation. Obviously, the decision lies in the hands of the legislature to determine how this works. We are simply here to say that we're open to that conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Senator Beyer. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following on Senator Beyer's commentary, there are some commissions that are so sensitive politically that we've chosen as a legislative branch to put the emphasis on balancing the interests on the committee and giving the committee the authority to select its own director or its own executive director and often president of the board. And the reason to do that is to keep that board or commission from becoming so highly politicized that a partisan officer, who's the governor, would be able to influence or unduly influence the outcomes. And so several of our boards and commissions are, in fact, beyond the purview of the governor to discipline, remove, or unduly influence, threaten, if you will. I guess I would give you as the example, I think it's Board of Forestry is probably the most obvious, but there are others. I'm not sure who is in charge of MLAC, but I can tell you that is as finely balanced as a Swiss clock. And if you mess with the balance, you mess with the outcomes, and everyone suffers. So in some instances, we've actually designed the system to be less political, perhaps, than it would be if the perpetual cloud of removal was hung over the board, commissioner, executive director. So, in those instances where the governor appoints, I see no harm in having the governor's approval to remove. That seems logical. In those places where the governor is intentionally insulated from that authority by the legislature, we ought to go very slowly and carefully in that direction and make sure that we preserve that firewall. So that's I often think that we just assume that stuff happens at random around here, which much of the time it does, but occasionally there's design, and we ought to be very sensitive to those places where their design exists.
Yes, as one of the sponsors of the bill, if you would allow me the opportunity to respond to the Vice Chair, I would welcome that. I think you're absolutely right, Senator Farioli. And the reason that I put so much emphasis in my opening remarks on how much a work in progress this is, I think that the example you cite is a perfect example of one where the possibility of politicization is so high that I'm just expressing on the record a willingness to amend the bill to specifically look at some some of those boards and commissions that uniquely should not be subject to this in its first iteration. I see this as a long conversation that may span a number of biennia. And if we make an incremental movement in a direction, terrific. But in no way, shape, or form do I think that this bill even should blanket apply. And I have spoken to some of the people who, once the bill was noticed, either caught me in the hall or came up to my office and said, you can't possibly mean us, and have been very generous in offering the chance to get to legislative council to draft amendments. I think that would be part of the policy discussion that this committee would have. Again, this bill is simply an opening to a conversation. One of the things that intrigued me was, as I began looking at some of these boards and commissions that we hold in such high regard, to have discovered in recent history that one actually had an executive director who had left state service, was collecting her retirement, and still conducting board meetings. I think that while we value the notion of these citizen advisory committees, that we need to be vigilant in making sure that they perform to the highest standards. And then to circle back around to your comment, there may be boards where the appointment of either the commission or, I mean, the exec should be held inviolate for any kind of politicization. And I agree with your comment.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes, Senator Farrell.
Just briefly, I think the last two iterations of the State Marine Board are really instructive. State Marine Board made a decision based on evidence that I think was correct in the case of Waldo Lake initially, and was subsequently mugged, cashiered, disciplined beyond reason. And if that were the model that we were to hold up to prospective board and commission members as the way we do business in Oregon, we wouldn't have any. They would just do what I think is the right thing and walk. Eventually, the enough of those members were intimidated or replaced that they made a different decision that was politically correct only in the context of the prevailing political wind. And that is exactly how boards and commissions should not be forced to function. So I just have to say that, you know, we have some really good examples of that firewall, and we have some really wretched examples of what happens when too much pressure is applied through the ability to intimidate from the executive branch.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrelly, I share your opinion in that regard.
Thank you, Senator Johnson, and thank you, I think, for your comments about this being a work in progress. I want to, as the chair, apologize to the public because we did post this hearing as a hearing on the -3 amendments, and obviously I haven't read the -5 amendments, and I'm sure the public had no opportunity to look at the -5 amendments since we didn't have them until shortly before the hearing. So for people who might be listening out in internet land, the -5 amendments are now posted on OLIS, but they are fairly extensive, so people can look at those at their leisure. But we were certainly not trying to mislead anybody about what we were hearing today, because the -3 amendments were the version that we had decided were the current version and when we posted this. So obviously work in progress is exactly what we're talking about. Okay, well, thank you, Senator Johnson, and we'll let you get about your ways and means.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and so I think we'll just keep going on 300 so we won't confuse everybody by skipping around, but I did want to mention for anybody that is in the room to hear SJR1 that we are not ready to hear SJR1 this morning. I don't think there's probably anybody here for it, but just so people will know. And so next we'll call John DiLorenzo, Gary Blackmer, and Katie Fast, unless there's some reason the three of you don't want to come up together. Good morning. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney in Portland. I am not appearing here today on behalf of any particular client. I am appearing as a private citizen who had a concern and am therefore in testifying in support of Senate Bill 300. I'm here for the Dash 3 amendments, although I want the committee to know that the Dash 5 amendments are okay with me, too. But my comments will be directed to the Dash 3 amendments, which were originally posted on OLIS, and then I will point out the difference between the two. I want to thank Senator Johnson, Senator Winters, the Governor's Office, and Legislative Council for all the time and effort that they have devoted to this project. It has truly been instructive, and as Senator Johnson mentioned, I hope that this will form the basis of a grand conversation about the proper role of a commission form of government versus an executive form of government. The inspiration for the bill was the public refusal of two high-profile state directors to step aside after the governor explicitly and publicly requested their resignations. They refused to step aside, which gave rise to an examination of what the governor's powers happened to be in those particular instances. I started with Article 3, Section 1 of our Constitution that divides our government into three distinctive branches, one of which is the executive branch. Article 5, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution makes it clear that the chief executive power of the state is vested in the governor. Section 10 requires him to see that the laws are properly executed, that the governor see that the laws are properly executed. Now, notwithstanding those commands, the governor is statutorily constrained from dismissing most top executive officials and members of policy boards and commissions until their terms expire. If top officials in agencies decide to resist the policy decisions made by the governor, of course, can cajole their respective boards and commissions to attempt to bring some compromise. But the governor has no recourse, really, for most of the boards and commissions other than to wait until the members' respective terms expire and to appoint new members of the boards and commissions. And that was, in fact, the recent experience with respect to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and its executive director. Most recent governors have campaigned on a platform of change. But change in the way that the executive branch does business is difficult to attain if major agency heads and commissions are not on the same page from a policy perspective. Every state agency has a letterhead which bears the name of the governor. The public naturally assumes that the governor is in charge. But the governor, in reality, cannot be held accountable for many of the decisions made by agencies because he truly has no control over them. Senate Bill 300 assures that the buck stops here. All this said, there is absolutely nothing in Senate Bill 300 or the Dash 3 or the Dash 5 amendments that requires the governor to micromanage agencies. As chief executive, any chief executive would want to cultivate independent-minded people who can develop expertise in areas to make most decisions that are routinely made by boards and commissions. But in those extraordinary circumstances in which the governor needs agencies to pursue one unified policy, he must have the authority to dismiss those who have purposely stood in the way. And finally, I predict, if vested with the authority to dismiss top administrators and boards and commissions, the governor will rarely have to use that authority, as the incidents like those which have inspired this bill would become truly few and far between. Now, with the chair's permission, I'd like to take an opportunity to explain the chart that has been passed out to you, and I think additional copies, I brought enough for the public consumption. And looking at the chart is probably a lot easier way to conceptualize what we're trying to do here than staring at the Dash 3 or the Dash 5 amendments.
And let's just take a moment to clarify for people who are listening to this hearing. Lori, is this chart posted on OLIS?
This chart is on.
So I apologize to members of the public that are trying to follow this and are not in the room. We do have a paper document in front of us that's color-coded, probably I'd say salmon and cornflower blue, but maybe my designer skills are not up to speed. And it's not labeled, actually, so I don't know how else to describe it, but I think I see people grabbing copies of it from the back of the room, so hopefully everybody who wants it.
And Madam Chair, I like your characterization of the colors, so I will use those. The chart lists a number of commissions and executive positions that were the subject of the discussions that took place between Senator Johnson, Senator Winters, myself, and the governor's office. If the position or the commission is in white, that means that that position already serves at the pleasure of the governor. On the right-hand side, there is a column called Notes on Current Statutory Language, and that tells you exactly what the current statutes provide for that commission or for that position. If the position is coded in light blue, that means that the governor is not allowed to remove that person at his pleasure, but the dash 5 amendments make it so. So, for instance, the superintendent of state police, currently the governor may only remove the superintendent for certain specified breaches after a hearing. The dash 5 amendments would allow the governor to remove the superintendent of state police for any reason or no reason. The rationale is that for some of these positions, they are policy positions and they are truly executive positions, and there should be one person ultimately in charge and responsible. If it is in salmon, that means it was the type of position that Senator Ferrioli discussed, one in which the parties felt it would be most appropriate to insulate that commission or that position from executive pressure or executive influence. Now, you may not see things the way that, you know, our recommendation unfolds. If that is the case, as you take a look at these positions, you will see section numbers in bold in the second column. So, for instance, if you were to focus on the director of the Public Employees Retirement Board, you would find to the right of that section 5. That means that change corresponds to section 5 in the dash 5 amendments. And so if you disagreed with that recommended policy choice and wanted to convert it back to the status quo in the bill, you could just then go to the dash 5 amendments and excise that section. So I hope that the chart will be useful as an exercise to help further discussion. One other comment, when you take a look at notes, you will find that some of these positions and some of these commissions hold office completely at the pleasure of the governor. Some do not. In some instances, the governor has no authority to remove. In other instances, he has the authority to remove for cause and a hearing. And although I am sensitive to Senator Ferrioli's suggestions and concerns, I have to say that when you take a look at these in their totality, although some of the commissions appear to have been the product of a design, others appear to have just grown like Topsy with no rhyme or reason as to why a certain position should be subject to total removal powers of the governor and others not. And I think a good example is in the natural resources area. Board of Forestry cannot be removed by the governor. They do not serve at his pleasure currently. However, the Water Resources Commission does. And both are equally politically charged, yet one decision has been made on one side, one on the other. And I submit it is likely because these decisions were not all made at one time, and they just grew over the years. And one thing that the chart shows very clearly is that there is no rhyme or reason as to how all of these in totality should work. In conclusion, I'd just like to thank you very much for the opportunity to maybe be a catalyst to begin this discussion. I truly feel that the public needs to know that the buck truly does stop at the governor's office. I think he is constitutionally mandated to have control of the executive branch, and I respectfully submit that given the way some of the statutes have evolved, he does not have that control which the Constitution requires him to have. Thank you very much for your time. I'm available to answer any questions you may have, and I look forward to a very interesting conversation.
Great, thank you. I think we'll hold questions until we've heard from all of you. And for the public, again, I think the aforementioned salmon and blue handout is in the process of being posted. And will it be salmon and blue, or do we know that?
Okay, great. Go ahead, please.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. For the record, my name is Gary Blackmer. I'm the Director of Audits for the Secretary of State's office. I want to apologize in advance for my hay fever. You will hopefully not get interrupted with my speaking too much. We issued an audit last year entitled Boards and Commissions, Common Risks, Needed Oversight, and Steps to Manage Them. We selected this topic because we had been initiated a number of audits of boards and commissions over the years having to do with administrative and financial and managerial issues that had arisen. And we issued those audit reports and found that there was some commonality. So we thought it would be appropriate to step back and really get a broad understanding of what was happening with boards and commissions in Oregon. And we found that they had proliferated from two before Oregon was a state to over 250 right now. And that they had a history of problems regarding the authority and accountability issues. For example, when we were looking at one of the boards, we found that the board members tended to cede their responsibilities to the executive director. In our 2003 audit of physical therapists, we found that, quote, the board delegated significant authority to the director without providing adequate review of her activities. We had another case when the director actions or inactions resulted in $55,000 in monetary losses of funds or uncontrolled or uncollected receivables. For us, these are issues around management and administration and compliance with state laws. They aren't necessarily around policy and the issues, for example, that Senator Ferrioli brought up around the Marine Board. Ironically, we did an audit of the Marine Board and found some serious problems in terms of management of public assets, spending decisions, and raise those. So from my perspective, we're looking at it, is the board adequately and appropriately delivering services to Oregonians is the issue that we have the biggest concern about. In our audit, we call for more training of board directors, greater expectations that they hold executive directors accountable for administrative, managerial, and especially performance issues. That's one area that we have not gotten into until very recently with boards is how well are they actually efficiently, effectively, and appropriately performing their mission to serve Oregonians. We recognize the broad value that they provide to Oregonians and the importance of it, but we also understand that they need to be held accountable to ensure that they are providing the best services. We can do that, but we also expect the board members to step up to do that. And it's a difficult and challenging responsibility to take on, and it doesn't always occur, is what we have found. So to the degree that this Senate Bill 300 has another opportunity, a stopgap mechanism for dealing with those situations when executive directors and boards have established relationships that don't necessarily provide the transparency and the accountability that's important, we think that this is one solution to address one aspect of the issues we identified in that audit. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there questions for the last two witnesses? Go ahead, Senator Beyer.
So did you see a difference between, for lack of a better description, the smaller regulatory boards and the bigger policy boards like the Board of Forestry or EQC?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, yes. As a matter of fact, for example, the Oregon Transportation Commission has a well-staffed
agency that helps provide it assistance for transparency and organizing, and the financial matters are really not something that are concerned to us. But those smaller ones where there are a few staff, they're handling substantial monies in some cases, and there isn't the segregation of duties, are a particular challenge. But that, again, that's only on the administrative side. In terms of, are they appropriately, fairly, equitably making decisions, delivering services, those are the kinds of things that we think are of utmost concern as well. And again, with small staffs, those can be difficult to keep up with the ups and downs of workload that changes. And so to the degree that the board has a lot of things it needs to be monitoring, and part-time volunteers may not be in the best position to ask all the right questions.
So we have, and I'm thinking off the top of my head here, but it seems like we have on the smaller boards three different structures, if you will. Some are totally independent, some are under the Department of Administrative Services, and others are under DCBS. It seems like the latter two, there's an administrative support structure that's there, sort of separates administration from policy, if you will.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, I believe that they have access to some of the procurement and payroll functions, but they don't. That does not necessarily address all the issues that they encounter. There are about 100 boards and commissions that provide some kinds of services to the public. They're governing boards or licensing boards. We haven't broken it down in those terms to identify it, but to the degree that they're all delivering something that Oregonians depend upon, whether they're professionals, get their licenses issued in a timely way, or whether it's actually some, you know, transportation or forestry, those are issues that I think are of concern to us from a managerial and performance standpoint.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Yeah. And so do I. So I'll go first, and then
yes,
you.
Ma'am.
How about that? So I just want to ask both Gary and John, the approach that this bill takes is essentially enumerating positions versus giving some broad authority, and there is another bill scheduled today also that does a much simpler change. And it seems to me it's essentially a political process, obviously, as we heard, the bill's a work in progress, as to which positions are addressed for removal authority. And I guess I'd like you to just address from a public policy perspective why you would take an approach like that of putting certain positions on the chopping block and others not, based on what sort of constituency group might be out there that would see this as perhaps giving too much authority to a governor because they didn't, you know, because maybe it wasn't malfeasance or any of the other things that are often seen as standards for removal, but just a more political retaliation type of removal. So how can you just address broadly why the enumerative approach is really the way to go, and then leaving everything else in what you've already described as a little bit of a chaotic situation?
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. John DiLorenzo for the record. I think we have to distinguish between functions, first of all. There are some boards and commissions that are licensing boards, and we specifically did not include those in the proposal because we did not view those as boards or positions that assist the governor in moving forward with a unified policy. They exist to enforce statutes that are enacted by you, and they protect the public, and they aid in furthering various professions. On the other hand, there are positions that are key to a governor furthering a policy that the governor wishes to pursue, and which the governor may have made the subject of a campaign. It seems to me that if a person is elected governor who campaigns to do certain things, that the governor should be given all of the tools of the executive branch that are available to effectuate the policy
that he was elected to pursue. And so this is an art more than a science. It was mine and those who work with me, our recommendation as to which those particular positions happen to be, ergo the enumeration of them. I don't consider anybody being on a chopping block. I think it's just a situation where if the chief executive has decided that the executive branch will pursue a policy, there are key lieutenants who must be on the same page. And if they aren't on the same page, no offense to them, the governor needs people who are, so the unified policy can be pursued. That was the rationale behind the initial choices.
Mr. Blackmore, did you have a response?
Chair Rosenbaum, I wasn't involved in that decision-making, but from the standpoint that it involves 200, I mean, we've got over 250 boards and commissions. I don't know that you could actually tackle all of them and comprehensively approach it. So it's more taking a part of it would be my assumption of what's going on. And it is a movement in the direction of trying to sort and organize those boards in a better way. So I didn't weigh in any way on which ones were chosen.
Okay. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was very closely aligned with the line of questioning that I might have gone. So I appreciate it.
Great mind, Senator Farioli.
Yes, ma'am. No argument with that. I think Mr. DiLorenzo's made a case for a systematic consideration, but he also admits that the grid that we have and the reflecting document is just first cut and arbitrary, you know, sorting out based on somebody's perception about whether or not their policy issues or would be reflective of the governor's agenda. You know, and if there's anything more hotly contested than a governor's agenda, I don't know what that might be. So it's always in the eye of the beholder. Sometimes one of the virtues of government is the fact that you can't coordinate it from top to bottom because it runs over people and does great harm, and anybody that believes that no person's property is secure nor life safe as long as the legislature is in session knows what I'm talking about. But for instance here was in years past, Director of Department of Forestry Brown refused to submit his letter of resignation when asked by the governor, and that created a huge controversy which blew over at about 15 minutes, and he was subsequently re-nominated and reconfirmed by the Senate and served an additional time as the director, having retired not too long ago, universally hailed as one of the best public servants that we ever had in the Board of to Forestry in Oregon. So the idea that he had the audacity not to resign simply was an assertion of the fact the governor didn't have the authority to ask for his resignation. So, you know, it seems to me that there are places where that intentional firewall ought to be respected, and we ought to be very systematic in the consideration of which is which. And I don't know that you do that just by doing something, you know, legislatively at the end of a legislative session rather than being very systematic about this. Mr. DiLorenzo mentioned that it would be rare that a governor would ever use removal power, and I wonder if that isn't because the power to remove is so intimidative to board and commission members that they would seek always to pleasure the governor, whatever his perceived will might be. And I'm not sure that's exactly how we ought to have boards and commissions operating, since they're supposed to reflect citizen input. They're supposed to be a pulse on the finger, or the finger on the pulse of the community, not necessarily a perfect alignment of a temporary and transitory political office holder, which the governor, notwithstanding the two or three terms, or possibly four, that we might be looking at, it's supposed to be temporary and transitory. So I'd like to hear Mr. DiLorenzo talk about which of these boards and commissions should that firewall be respected in, and how should we get to a process of sorting them out? Should there be a more thoughtful process, or should we just take a shot at it this legislative session and call it a good thing?
Madam Chair, Senator Ferrioli, thank you very much for the question. And I have a rejoinder and then I have a comment. The rejoinder to your very well articulated position about a commission form of government is that if a governor is elected on a mandate to do a certain thing, to pursue a certain policy, the governor should have the tools available. And in fact, the public would expect that the governor would have the tools available to pursue that mandate. I respectfully submit that that is not currently the case right now. I do agree with you that the examination should be systematic. And in fact, I think it is pretty obvious that I agree with that, because if I were advocating a binary choice for you to make, I would not provide you a chart which invites your ability to pick and choose and mix and match. And so that truly is the intention here, that the idea is to begin a discussion. I do think it is obvious, though, when one takes a look at the right-hand side of this right-hand column of this large chart, that there is no unified theory that binds the way we deal with even policy boards. And I think, again, the best example is the disparate treatment currently between the Board of Forestry and the Water Resources Commission. I mean, both are equally subject to controversy. Both are policy boards. One is subject to immediate removal power by the governor. One is not. And then finally, as to the point about the intimidating cloud, I guess, that would surround an executive who always had to please the governor, that's no different than private enterprise. There are very few business organizations which do not have clear lines of reporting. And I respectfully submit that some who say that there should be total independence for some of these policy boards from the chief executive, the firms they work for would never run their organizations that way. The way they would run their organizations is to have reporting to the chief executive, but you don't find wholesale intimidation. If you have a good chief executive, you have one who encourages independent viewpoints and thoughts, but at the end of the day, there is one policy decision, and that's what this bill is intended to promote. It may do it inartfully right now, but that's the discussion that we need to precipitate.
Madam Chair, I have one question. Actually, it's for Mr.
Blackmere.
Mr. Blackmere, in a comment for Mr. DiLorenzo. When Mr. DiLorenzo is wearing his political hat, a mandate is 50% plus one vote. So mandates are very much in the eye of the beholder. When we did the audit of boards and commissions, and it was focused essentially on the issue of the executive directors, did you make any conclusions about board member education being an issue that perhaps we ought to pay some attention to?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Ferrioli, yes, that was specifically one of our recommendations, that board members need to be more trained on what the expectations are for a state agency that complies with proper procurement, payroll, financial rules and procedures, and also an expectation that they monitor regularly those transactions and activities to make sure that the staff are in compliance with it, because the buck stops with board members in that case. They are the governing oversight agency, and from a managerial standpoint. And so we've seen other jurisdictions that provide that kind of training. There was training of that sort in the state of Oregon until a number of years ago when I believe DAS cut the training out of its budget. So that helps to a certain degree, but one of the issues I think that I have found is those are difficult kinds of discussions to have with executives and their staff, by board members, by volunteers, and even I think Willamette Education Service District is an example of a board that essentially accepted what the superintendent was telling them in many cases, and they should have been asking harder questions and uncomfortable questions, and those don't always happen. Annual performance evaluations of the executive directors are another expectation that we think is important, and those are things that can create difficult conversations as well. So having volunteers undertake those kinds of challenging situations, I think, is not an easy expectation of them either.
Madam Chair, just an observation. We should be aware that often boards and commissions have designations that are very descriptive about who it is that people represent as a member. And I don't mean to pick on the Board of Forestry, but you've got small woodland owners, east side owners, large industrial landowners, west side, north, south. I mean, you look at various descriptors, and there's a specific appointment for a specific subset of population within a larger group of people that are affected by that board or commission's decisions. And we clearly expect them to represent that perspective on the board. And whether it comports with the governor's pleasure or not is something we ought to consider. You know, whether or not the overriding consideration is, look, you're there to represent a specific point of view. You know, we have those descriptors throughout the roster of appointments, and we ought to pay attention to those. If we're going to compare whether or not the chief executive should have a moral authority, a legal authority, a statutory authority, and more than just ordinary suasion over how they think and who they represent, you know, maybe we ought to take a look at the descriptors or make some systematic approach as an exception if they do have a really specific mandate that's statutory, and we do that here in the legislature. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your comment, Senator Farioli, and thank you both for your testimony.
Thank you,
Ms. Fast, for waiting so patiently.
No problem. Good morning. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon subject. Farm Bureau. I'm here in just request of the Dash 5 amendments, which remove the Board of Forestry and the Department of Forestry, which you've heard quite a bit of discussion around this morning. Those entities are on the commission side, are appointed to strive a balance of stakeholders and interests that focuses on the outcomes and the management of the agency and their resources, and not the politics. And that's the concern that I believe the landowner community has with adding the forestry programs to the legislation. The Dash 5s also remove the Soil and Water Commission, which acts more like a commodity commission in advising the Department of Agriculture on water quality and natural resource programs, and doesn't manage an agency like what you'll see with the other boards and directors that are listed on the chart. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thanks for your very succinct and clear testimony. Any questions for Ms. Fast? I don't see any. Okay, thanks everybody. And we have two more people signed up on this bill, so we'll call them both. And they are Tom Wolf and Marcia Kelly, if you're both still here, if you'd like to come forward. And while you're getting settled, I'll mention, members, there is written testimony that is posted on OLIS. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to look at it, but I have been scanning it. It's from the League of Women Voters, from 1,000 Friends, and from some other people, too, in response to these Dash 3 amendments. So please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, representing Trout Unlimited, the largest cold water conservation group in the nation here in the state of Oregon. I come conditionally to oppose SB 300. The principle of what they're trying to do, I understand and I support, but I hadn't seen the Dash 5 amendments until just a few minutes ago. I came to oppose the Dash 3 amendments as they pertain to the Board of Forestry and ODFW. Obviously, the Dash 5 have taken away my concerns about the Board of Forestry, and I echo the comments of Katie Foss that I believe the Board of Forestry is a very balanced board, and it shouldn't be threatened by the power of the governor to destroy that bond. Now where I have a problem is Section 24, which is how it would affect the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Director's job. It would give the governor the unconditional ability to remove the director, and I have a real problem with that. I believe currently, and I have been testifying and working with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission for 20 years. I've testified before them more than any other person. I have sat on more boards and committees than any other person. I know that commission well, and I believe it runs like a fine oiled machine where citizen board members, commission members are appointed and serve to represent different parts of the stakeholder community, and they have currently have the right to appoint and remove the director, and this language of the Dash 5 would give the governor the ability to remove without cause. So I have problems with that. I ask that that be changed, and I also ask that this is a great concept, this is a great idea, but to discuss and look at this in the short amount of time that's left in the session, I don't believe we have, and I ask that this concept be extended until the next session. It be looked at in parts. The Natural Resource Agency should be looked at by Natural Resource Agency policy committees. So I ask that that be done also. So all in all, TU supports some of the concepts. We don't like how the ODFW director job is looked at, and we ask that this concept be extended over a longer period of time. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Thank you for rushing in, and please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Kelly, and I'm the public policy advocate for the American Association of University Women. We have members across the state, Pendleton, Baker, Ontario, and, of course, throughout the Willamette Valley. We, probably have comments somewhat similar to what you have for the League of Women Voters. We understand the needs of the executive of the state to be able to appoint heads of agencies. I do have, and we do have, concerns about a full ability to remove commissioners on commissions at will. A healthy dialogue and different points of view are important to Oregonians, and I know that on the Transportation Commission, they try to make sure that there is a variety of views as well as a variety of areas that are served. And as a step down from the Transportation Committee, as a person who serves on the Area Commission on Transportation for this area, I think you may have referred to it in part of your statement, Senator Ferrioli. Having a healthy exchange of different views on transportation or having a healthy exchange of different views on education serves all Oregonians. Having something in lockstep only to be politically correct, I don't believe is a really good thing for the state. I would appreciate more of an ability for more Oregonians to be able to discuss this, and I think that I would be happy if the bill did not move forward and we kept in discussion rather than wholesaling changing the way that we work with boards and commissions of the state.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. And that completes our sign-up sheet. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 300. And I believe we are still open on Senate Bill 789, and so we'll go back because we have two more people who've been waiting patiently to talk about that bill, and they are Terry Burton and Debbie Johnson, if you both would like to come forward. Thanks for listening patiently to that very fascinating discussion. And now we're back on Senate Bill 789. So
good morning.
Let's go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli. My name for the record is Debbie Johnson, and I'm the Health Resource Coordinator for Beaverton School District. And we're here today to talk in support of the Dash 2 Amendment for Senate Bill 789. We very much appreciate the work that Senator Haas and Justin Black from the OEA with our group has come up with this compromise of the Dash 2 amendment. We've already provided you with statements from several school districts, both small and large, who are currently outside of OEBB. Some are, for the record, partially in OEBB. Some of their bargaining groups either elected to join OEBB or because of their situation, they fell into OEBB because they were in a group that was no longer having a pool at the time in 2007. So that's why they're, like my friend here today, Terry Burton will speak, because she is one of those groups that has portions in and portions out of OEBB. Basically, we gave you a chart from the Independent Educators Benefit Alliance that shows that these 11 districts have saved $63 million outside of OEBB. We just feel that this is a very administrative burden, as Senator Haas spoke about, and there are costs. It varies by district every 2 years, and there's costs to OEB as well in performing the review. So I don't think I need to say any more about this Dash 2 amendment. It clearly allows bargaining groups or districts who wish to go into OEB to request a comparability analysis. We are just asking not to have the mandatory every 2 year analysis be performed. So thank you very much. And if you have questions, I'm happy to answer.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Hi, I'm Terry Burton, Director of Benefits and Compensation for Portland Public Schools. And thank you, Senator Rosenbaum, for letting us come here to talk to you and committee. Portland Public Schools is one of those unique that are in and out, and the reason being that we have a trust, and 3/4 of our employees are in a trust, which was exempt at the time that the OEB was formed. And for every year, every comparability that we have had since the inception, for our group, our 3,500 employees who are out, we've saved averaging $8 million a year in premiums by being able to manage our plan, have access to our claims data, we are fortunate in being in a market where there are many different options for us, and also because of our size, we are able to negotiate plans that are good for our employees, actually richer plans than the ones currently being offered by OEB at a better price. I think Debbie's pretty much said everything else about our group. I think we have complied with the rules and ran our comparabilities. It costs the school district about $10,000 every time we have to do that. It is a large exercise. It isn't a simple exercise. And we also feel that some of the comparability may have some conflicts and might not be a perfect science either. So we just appreciate you moving this real forward. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, you raise an interesting point where you have some in and some out. Mm-hmm. So how do you react to Senator Starr's proposal that all districts be offered the opportunity to go out?
I guess with Portland, no. If you had that opportunity, would you take all of your employees out?
Yes, because we could realize quite a savings by putting our employees back in the trust. We have 1,200 active and retirees in the OA plan right now, and we would definitely want to do that if we could.
It does seem like I wasn't in the legislature when they created OA, but it seemed like the whole idea was, in traditional insurance, if you put everybody in, you'll drive the cost down. But it seems like it's one of those legislative solutions where you left the big guys out and so you didn't save anybody any money.
And I don't know if that's true, Senator Beyer, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, in response. As you can see from the list we gave you, there are both large and small districts present. Fern Ridge, in their statement, will tell you that they have less than 200 employees, and they are able, in their market, to be able to save money. Central School District is also a smaller school district than either Beaverton or Portland, and they're both in and out as well, and with the group that is out, they're able to save money. So I think I'm not an insurance agent person, but what I understand from what they've shared with me is that, yes, a bigger pool helps, but there is a limit to that pool. So once you get to a certain pool size, there aren't the results that a continuing downward trend. And in Beaverton's case, we have a group of over 8,000 lives. That includes dependents. And we are called a creditable group just based on our size by ourselves. That's my understanding.
Okay. Oh, Senator Farioli.
This, Madam Chair, seems to be a season of paradox. Listen to testimony that I agreed with from Trout Unlimited and the League of University Women so far this morning. Now I'm going to offer an opinion that is apparently in opposition to saving money for a school district. When the OEB was created, it was supposed to bend the cost curve. It is up. And many of us that were skeptical of OEB to begin with said, you know, really, what you need to do is remove obstacles to a very robust marketplace so that people could use the power of consumerism to find the best product at the lowest prices, and that's what these folks have proven. And the reason we asked the audit to be mandatory over 2 years is to document the delta, which you've done. You've shown that the costs of OEB, that cost curve is being bent upward. And that is exactly the opposite of how that program was built and sold to legislators, and that you, by accessing the private market, have bent the cost curve downward. So, you know, I hate to tell you this, but the idea that you had a mandate for the documentation that you have to do that cost you $10,000 was so that we in the legislature could backtrack and look and see what actually happened as that delta grows. So we got a 2-year snapshot in district by district of how badly OEB is off track. So I'm sorry that you ended up holding the bag, but you certainly have provided a service that otherwise we wouldn't possibly have. Perhaps that exercise has served its purpose now, and these folks need to be freed from that obligation. But I got to tell you, having the documentation on the upward bent curve of OEB is really catalyzes or should catalyze a pretty sharp discussion about whether or not we perhaps blundered into an area the legislature should have avoided. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you for your comments, Senator Farioli, and thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Okay, and we don't have anybody else to signed up on Senate Bill 789, and we also do not have paperwork on this bill this morning on the dash 2, nor do we have paperwork, obviously, on the dash 3, which we just got. So
it's been forwarded to staff, so it should be nice.
Great. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 789, and we have one more bill to take up. And so I'll open public hearing and work session, possible work session on House Bill 2215. And Lori, could you tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2215 provides the person holding a point of office in state government serves at the pleasure of the point of power making the appointment, clarifies that person may be removed from appointment to board or commission by the appointing authority unless a different standard for removal is specified by law. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued, and it moved across the House floor on a 47-13 vote.
Okay, thank you, Lori, for that explanation. Members, I know we're really interested in these other bills, too, but now we're on House Bill 2215. Okay, and do we have a sign-up sheet on this? Okay, and it looks like Leonie Reeves is signed up to testify on this bill, if you'd like to come forward. Thank you for waiting so patiently.
No problem. Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Leonie Reeves, and I'm General Counsel to Governor Kitzhaber. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2215, and I'd like to start by talking a little bit about what House Bill 2215 does not do and contrast it to what Senate Bill 300 does, the bill that you heard two bills prior that was the subject of a lively discussion. First of all, House Bill 2215 is not specific to the governor's authority. This applies to any appointive authority, so that could be the governor, it could be legislative leadership, it could be the chief justice. It applies to any appointed position, regardless of who makes the appointment. It is also not a bill that expands any existing authority or changes any standards of removal. So Senate Bill 300 takes an enumerated approach, looks at certain appointments of both boards and commission members and agency heads and changes the removal authority or changes the standard of removal. House Bill 2215 does not do any of that. It does not change any removal standard that's currently in statute or expand an authority that's currently in statute. What House Bill 2215 does is clarifies what we believe is the existing law when there is no removal standard at issue or that's explicit in a statute. And I think the best way I can explain that is to use the helpful chart that was provided in Senate Bill 300 with the salmon and the blue to describe the different ways that appointments are described in statutes. You typically see three different ways these appointments are drafted. The first way they're drafted is that appointed person serves a term of office like 4 years, and it is explicit that the person serves at the pleasure of the appointing authority. And in the chart, the white boxes are explicit that the director of the administrative services is the first one on page one. The governor is appointed, and in that last right-hand column, it explicitly says hold office at the pleasure of the governor. So that language is explicit that the term serves at the pleasure of the governor. The second way these statutes are drafted are the salmon type of situation on the chart, and that is a situation where there is an appointment there, but there is also a specific removal standard in the statute, and usually that's a for-cause standard, like he can only or she can only be removed for malfeasance or abuse of duty or those types of enumerated standards. The third type of way we see these statutes is not on this chart. It's where there is no language about what the removal standard is. It simply says a person is appointed for a term of office such as 4 years. So what House Bill 2215 does is provides clarity that when there is no appointments or removal standard in the statute explicit, that the default standard is that they serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority. And there are a number of statutes throughout the revised statutes that provide this type of appointment situation where it's just a term of office and then there's no language about what the removal standard is. So what House Bill 2215 does explicitly is it amends a statute, ORS 236-140, which was already in statute that provides a default standard of sorts. It basically says that lost the text of the actual bill. What the statute did say was that any person holding an appointed office in any office, department, or institution of the state, so again, this is not just explicit to the governor, shall hold for an indefinite period of time, not exceeding 4 years, and shall be subject to removal by the appointed power. What this change in 2215 does is it adds and clarifies that even if there's a term specified by law, for example, a term of 4 years, that the statute still applies to that. And it also specifies that the removal standard is serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority. But it also makes it explicit that this statute only applies unless a different standard of removal is specified in law. And you'll see the language that was added in bold on line 9 and 10 that makes it clear that this is truly a default standard. A couple of issues that came up on the House side that I just wanted to bring to your attention. One was whether or not this would apply to local government appointments. It does not. This statute, ORS 236140, only applies to state offices, so city and county appointments are actually governed by a different subset of statutes, and that was actually the main thing. The other concern that was discussed on the House side was whether or not boards like the Workers' Comp Board that had a for-cause removal standard in statute, whether or not this changed those types of removal standards, and as I've stated, it does not. So I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. We believe that this is more of a technical fix than a substantive change to clear up an ambiguity in the law, and would appreciate the support of this committee in that.
Okay, thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the commissions that I'm familiar with since I used to serve on it is the Land Conservation and Development Commission, and that the director of the I see what you're saying here. I got confused by the chart. So the under this statute on the chart that we have here, the light blue thing, it says the governor does not have removal power, and the appointing body is the LCDC commission. So under this, the commission would have removal power under this House bill.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, correct. It does not change the removal power from the commission to the governor, nor does it change the standard of removal. So there would make no change to the LCDC.
Okay, statutes. So it's already, the LCDC in the statute already has, the commission already has removal power?
I don't have the explicit, Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, I don't have the statutory language in front of me, but it appears from the chart that the LCDC commissioners may be removed by the governor only for cause, and that the LCDC director may only be removed by the commission.
By the commission for any reason?
I don't have the statute, the language, so I don't know what the removal standard is.
Okay, and then on the Transportation Commission, I'll withdraw that question. I think it's cleared up. The chart is a little hard for me to understand in places. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you, Senator Burdick. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two questions. One, from experience and observations, even in the private side, sometimes the at-will isn't really at-will. You often get into a whole lot of cases where you're still looking for cause when someone was it a inappropriate termination. Does this change any of that? I mean, I think sometimes there's a sense that someone's doing a great job, I just decide I don't like them anymore and I can fire them, and that obviously many times ends up in some very expensive lawsuits. But it seems like the same would apply to government. In fact, I've seen it apply to government.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, members of the committee, the bill as it makes the amendments does not change any standard legally. So if somebody serves at will today, they will continue to serve at will. If somebody can only be removed for cause, they will continue to only be able to be removed
for cause. I think that part of what you're getting at in your question is sort of the letter of the law versus the implementation and practice of employers in removal. And in terms of whether or not it would change, it's not intended to change practice. What it's intended to do is clarify the law so that when an appointing authority does make a choice to remove a commissioner or a member that serves, that it is clear statutorily under the letter of the law that they have that authority to remove. I don't know if that quite answered your question.
Yeah, sort of. It's a muddy area.
It is.
The other one is Mr. DiLorenzo's issues and philosophic points aside, I don't understand why this bill's here. You currently have, where you have that authority, it's very clear you have that authority, not you, but the appointing authority. Why is, what does this bill do? I don't really see it as clarifying anything.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, the bill clears up an ambiguity, and albeit that ambiguity is probably one that's only discussed among geeky talks among lawyers, but there is an ambiguity in the current statute about whether the language that says shall hold, and it's on line 6, shall hold the same for an indefinite term not exceeding 4 years, and the current statute says shall at all times be subject to removal. Since there is no standard of removal, if it's for cause or at will, specified in the current statute, there is a ambiguity about whether or not the person can be removed for any reason and serves at the pleasure or must be removed for cause. We believe and have always believed that the removal default standard is that they can be removed for any reason and that they serve at the pleasure of the appointing authority. This statute makes that explicit, that it's not, the default standard isn't a for-cause removal since the language is silent.
Yes, Senator Burdick.
You know, just to clarify, and again, you know, when we do these statutes, sometimes we think of these things and sometimes we don't, and I'm sure that's what this bill is about, is to provide some uniformity. But there's nothing in this bill that would preclude in any way the changing of the standard if the legislature decided that in a particular case that it maybe should be for cause, or, you know, there's nothing to preclude that. Is that correct?
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, that's absolutely correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Right, I think that's a good clarification, and I do want to mention, I don't think she would mind me saying this, that when I discussed this bill with Senator Johnson earlier and whether it would be inconsistent with the other bill, she said no, that she supports both approaches. So I think that should be said, that this bill is a clarification but doesn't preclude other kinds of changes from being made. Okay, any other questions? Well, yes, Senator Farrell.
This only applies to employees.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Beyer, this applies to any appointed position, so it would apply to volunteer appointments on boards and commissions as well as appointed employees.
Senator Farrell.
Madam Chair, thank you. Probably for the first time I've concluded differently than learned counsel has on whether or not this is a policy change. I think it is, but one that we may want to look at. It does change the standard. For cause is rebuttable. It could lead to lawsuits. Mm-hmm. At will is really not debatable. So it possibly removes a cause of action and makes a removal a lot less likely to be litigated. So I think what that does is it does clarify, but it also clears the way, as opposed to us being wrapped around the axle of a for-cause lawsuit that, you know, certainly people would want to contest that if their fitness to serve was in question. So, you know, maybe a small point, but I think it does change the standard, but perhaps it improves it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I don't think you need to comment on that. So, okay, thank you very much for your testimony. And we don't have anybody else signed up to testify on this bill. So, members, we are in a work session. Senator Farrell, did you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I
I want to look more carefully at this piece of legislation. I don't necessarily oppose it. I just want to study it a little bit more.
Well, I think we are ready to move the bill, but if, as a courtesy, you're requesting more time to look at the bill before it leaves committee, I can certainly accommodate you.
Madam Chair, if you want to move the bill, do so.
Okay.
I may vote no, but reserve the right to vote,
yes
on the floor.
Okay.
After I look at it a little bit closer.
It just would be great if we could move
yes,
the bill.
Yes, Madam Chair, I don't, wish to be obstructionist.
Yes.
I would move House Bill 2215A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2215A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. I think we've had a good discussion about this bill, and I apologize, I don't know your name. Zoe, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Aye.
Senator Farioli?
Maybe.
I'm sorry. No. But I'll reserve the right to vote yes on the floor for left this bill.
Aye.
Senator Starr?
What's aye?
Senator Burdick?
Aye. And the motion carries. And do we have a volunteer to carry this? If not, the chair will carry it. Okay. And members, with nothing further to come before us today, I will close the work session on House Bill 2215, and we are adjourned. Thank you.